While Father Coram was talking to the other leaders, she took the tin to Yorick Birnison and explained her idea. It had come to her when she remembered his slicing so easily through the metal of the engine cover. He listened, and then took the lid of a biscuit tin and deftly folded it into a small, flat cylinder. She marvelled at the skill of his hands. Unlike most bears, he and his kin had opposable thumb claws with which they could hold things still to work on them. And he had some innate sense of the strength and flexibility of metals, which meant that he only had to lift it once or twice, flex it this way and that, and he could run a claw over it in a circle to score it for folding. He did this now, folding the sides in and in until they stood in a raised rim and then making a lid to fit it. At Lyra's bidding, he made two, one the same size as the original smoke leaf tin, and another just big enough to contain the tin itself and a quantity of hairs and bits of moss and lichen all packed down tight to smother the noise. When it was closed, it was the same size and shape as the alethiometer. When that was done, she sat next to Yorick Birnison as he gnawed a haunch of reindeer that was frozen as hard as wood.
Yorick, is it hard not having a demon? Don't you get lonely?
Lonely? I don't know. They tell me this is cold. I don't know what cold is because I don't freeze, so I don't know what lonely means either. Bears are made to be solitary.
What about the Svalbard bears? There's thousands of them, ain't there? That's what I heard.
He said nothing but ripped the joint in half with a sound like a splitting log.
Beg pardon, Yorick. I hope I ain't offended you. It's just that I'm curious. See, I'm extra curious about the Svalbard bears because of my father.
Who is your father?
Lord Asriel. And they got him captive on Svalbard, you see. I think the goblins betrayed him and paid the bears to keep him in prison.
I don't know. I am not a Svalbard bear.
I thought you was.
No, I was a Svalbard bear, but I am not now. I was sent away as a punishment because I killed another bear. So I was deprived of my rank and my wealth and my armor and sent out to live at the edge of the human world and fight when I could find employment at it, or work at brutal tasks and drown my memory in raw spirits.
Why did you kill the other bear?
Anger. There are ways among bears of turning away our anger with each other, but I was out of my own control. So I killed him, and I was justly punished.
And you were wealthy and high-ranking, just like my father, Yorick. That's just the same with him after I was born. He killed someone too, and they took all his wealth away. That was long before he got made a prisoner on Svalbard, though. I don't know anything about Svalbard except it's in the farthest north. Is it all covered in ice? Can you get there over the frozen sea?
Not from this coast. The sea is sometimes frozen south of it, sometimes not. You would need a boat.
Or a balloon, maybe.
Or a balloon, yes, but then you would need the right wind.
He gnawed the reindeer haunch, and a wild notion flew into Lyra's mind as she remembered all those witches in the night sky. But she said nothing about that. Instead, she asked Yorick Birnison about Svalbard, and listened eagerly as he told her of the slow-crawling glaciers, the rocks and ice floes where the bright tusked walruses lay in groups of 100 or more, of the seas teeming with seals, of narwhals clashing their long white tusks above the icy water, of the great grim iron-bound coast, the cliffs 1,000 feet and more high where the foul cliff ghasts perched and swooped, the coal pits and the fire mines where the bear smiths hammered out mighty sheets of iron and riveted them into armour.
If they took your armour away, Yorick, where did you get this set from?
I made it myself in Nova Zembla from sky metal. Until I did that, I was incomplete.
So bears can make their own souls,
she said. There was a great deal in the world to know.
Who is the king of Svalbard? Do bears have a king?
He is called Jofur Ragnarsson.
That name shook a little bell in Lyra's mind. She'd heard it before, but where? And not in a bear's voice either, nor in Egyptian's. The voice that had spoken it was a scholar's, precise and pedantic and lazily arrogant, very much a Jordan College voice. She tried it again in her mind. Oh, she knew it so well. And then she had it. The retiring room, the scholars listening to Lord Asriel. It was the Palmerian professor who had said something about Jofur Ragnarsson. He'd used the word panserbjörna, which Lyra didn't know, and she hadn't known that Jofur Ragnarsson was a bear. But what was it he'd said? The king of Svalbard was vain, and he could be flattered. There was something else, if only she could remember it, but so much had happened since then.
If your father is a prisoner of the Svalbard bears, he will not escape. There is no wood there to make a boat. On the other hand, if he is a nobleman, he will be treated fairly. They will give him a house to live in and a servant to wait on him, and food and fuel.
Could the bears ever be defeated, Yorick?
No.
Or tricked, maybe?
He stopped gnawing and looked at her directly. Then he said,
"You will never defeat the armored bears. You have seen my armor. Now look at my weapons."
He dropped the meat and held out his paws, palm upward, for her to look at. Each black pad was covered in horny skin an inch or more thick, and each of the claws was as long as Lyra's hand at least, and as sharp as a knife. He let her run her hands over them wonderingly.
"One blow will crush a seal's skull, or break a man's back, or tear off a limb. And I can bite. If you had not stopped me in Trollesund, I would have crushed that man's head like an egg. So much for strength. Now for trickery. You cannot trick a bear. You want to see proof? Take a stick and fence with me."
Eager to try, she snapped a stick off a snow-laden bush, trimmed all the side shoots off, and swished it from side to side like a rapier. Jorik Birnason sat back on his haunches and waited, four paws in his lap. When she was ready, she faced him, but she didn't like to stab at him because he looked so peaceable. So she flourished it, feinting to right and left, not intending to hit him at all, and he didn't move. She did that several times, and not once did he move so much as an inch. Finally, she decided to thrust at him directly, not hard, but just to touch the stick to his stomach. Instantly, his paw reached forward and flicked the stick aside. Surprised, she tried again with the same result. He moved far more quickly and surely than she did. She tried to hit him in earnest, wielding the stick like a fencer's foil, and not once did it land on his body. He seemed to know what she intended before she did, and when she lunged at his head, the great paw swept the stick aside harmlessly, and when she fainted, he didn't move at all. She became exasperated and threw herself into a furious attack, jabbing and lashing and thrusting and stabbing, and never once did she get past those paws. They moved everywhere, precisely in time to parry, precisely at the right spot to block. Finally, she was frightened and stopped. She was sweating inside her furs, out of breath, exhausted, and the bear still sat impassive. If she had had a real sword with a murderous point, he would have been quite unharmed.
"I bet you could catch bullets,"
she said, and threw the stick away.
"How do you do that?"
"By not being human. That's why you could never trick a bear. We see tricks and deceit as plain as arms and legs. We can see in a way humans have forgotten. But you know about this. You can understand the symbol reader."
"That ain't the same, is it?"
She was more nervous of the bear now than when she had seen his anger.
"It is the same. Adults can't read it, as I understand, as I am to human fighters, so you are to adults with the symbol reader."
"Yes, I suppose. Does that mean I'll forget how to do it when I grow up?"
"Who knows? I have never seen a symbol reader, nor anyone who could read them. Perhaps you are different from others."
He dropped to all fours again and went on gnawing his meat. Lyra had unfastened her furs, but now the cold was striking in again and she had to do them up. All in all, it was a disquieting episode. She wanted to consult the alethiometer there and then, but it was too cold, and besides, they were calling for her because it was time to move on. She took the tin boxes that Jorik Birnason had made, put the empty one back into Fardacorum's kit bag, and put the one with the spy fly in it, together with the alethiometer, in the pouch at her waist. She was glad when they were moving again. The leaders had agreed with Lee Scoresby that when they reached the next stopping place, they would inflate his balloon and he would spy from the air. Naturally, Lyra was eager to fly with him, and naturally it was forbidden. But she rode with him on the way there and pestered him with questions.
Mr. Scoresby, how would you fly to Svalbard?
You'd need a dirigible with a gas engine, something like a Zeppelin, or else a good south wind, but hell, I wouldn't dare. Have you ever seen it? The bleakest, barest, most inhospitable, godforsaken dead end of nowhere.
I was just wondering, if Yorick Bernison wanted to go back...
He'd be killed. Yorick's in exile. As soon as he set foot there, they'd tear him to pieces.
How do you inflate your balloon, Mr. Scoresby?
Two ways. I can make hydrogen by pouring sulfuric acid onto iron filings. You catch the gas it gives off and gradually fill the balloon like that. The other way is to find a ground gas vent near a fire mine. There's a lot of gas under the ground here, and rock oil besides. I can make gas from rock oil if I need to. And from coal as well. It's not hard to make gas, but the quickest way is to use ground gas. A good vent will fill the balloon in an hour.
How many people can you carry?
Six, if I need to.
Could you carry Yorick Bernison in his armor?
I have done. I rescued him one time from the Tartars when he was cut off and they were starving him out. That was in the Tunguska campaign. I flew in and took him off. Sounds easy, but hell, I had to calculate the weight of that old boy by guesswork. And then I had to bank on finding ground gas under the ice fort he'd made. But I could see what kind of ground it was from the air, and I reckoned we'd be safe in digging. See, to go down, I have to let gas out of the balloon, and I can't get airborne again without more. Anyway, we made it, armor and all.
Mr. Scoresby, you know the Tartars make holes in people's heads.
Oh, sure. They've been doing that for thousands of years. In the Tunguska campaign, we captured five Tartars alive, and three of them had holes in their skulls. One of them had two.
They do it to each other.
That's right. First, they cut partway around a circle of skin on the scalp so they can lift up a flap and expose the bone. Then they cut a little circle of bone out of the skull, very carefully, so they don't penetrate the brain, and then they sew the scalp back over.
I thought they did it to their enemies.
Hell no. It's a great privilege. They do it so the gods can talk to them.
Did you ever hear of an explorer called Stanislaus Grumman?
Grumman? Sure. I met one of his team when I flew over the Yenisei River 2 years back. He was going to live among the Tartar tribes up that way. Matter of fact, I think he had that hole in the skull done. It was part of an initiation ceremony, but the man who told me didn't know much about it.
So, if he was like an honorary Tartar, they wouldn't have killed him.
Killed him? Is he dead, then?
Yeah, I saw his head... My father found it. I saw it when he showed it to the scholars at Jordan College in Oxford. They'd scalped it and all.
Who'd scalped it?
Well, the Tartars. That's what the scholars thought. But maybe it wasn't.
It might not have been Grumman's head. Your father might have been misleading the scholars.
I suppose he might. He was asking them for money.
And when they saw the head, they gave him the money?
Yeah.
Good trick to play. People are shocked when they see a thing like that. They don't like to look too close.
Especially scholars.
Well, you'd know better than I would. But if that was Grumman's head, I'll bet it wasn't the Tartars who scalped him. They scalped their enemies, not their own. And he was a Tartar by adoption.
Lyra turned that over in her mind as they drove on. There were wide currents full of meaning flowing fast around her. The gobblers and their cruelty... Their fear of dust, the city in the Aurora, her father in Svalbard, her mother, and where was she? The alethiometer, the witches flying northward. And poor little Tony Makarios, and the clockwork spyfly, and Yorick Bernison's uncanny fencing. She fell asleep, and every hour they drew closer to Bolvanger. Chapter 14. Bolvanger Lights. The fact that the Egyptians had heard or seen nothing of Mrs. Coulter worried Father Coram and John Farr more than they let Lyra know, but they weren't to know that she was worried too. Lyra feared Mrs. Coulter and thought about her often. And whereas Lord Asriel was now father, Mrs. Coulter was never mother. The reason for that was Mrs. Coulter's demon, the golden monkey, who had filled Pantalaimon with a powerful loathing, and who, Lyra felt, had pried into her secrets, and particularly that of the alethiometer. and they were bound to be chasing her. It was silly to think otherwise. The spy fly proved that, if nothing else. But when an enemy did strike, it wasn't Mrs. Coulter. The Egyptians had planned to stop and rest their dogs, repair a couple of sledges, and get all their weapons into shape for the assault on Bolvanger. John Farr hoped that Lee Scoresby might find some ground gas to fill his smaller balloon, for he had two, apparently, and go up to spy out the land. However, the aeronaut attended to the condition of the weather as closely as a sailor, and he said there was going to be a fog. And sure enough, as soon as they stopped, a thick mist descended. Lee Scoresby knew he'd seen nothing from the sky, so he had to content himself with checking his equipment, though it was all in meticulous order. Then, with no warning at all, a volley of arrows flew out of the dark. Three Egyptian men went down at once and died so silently that no one heard a thing. Only when they slumped clumsily across the dog traces or lay unexpectedly still did the nearest men notice what was happening, and then it was already too late because more arrows were flying at them. Some men looked up, puzzled by the fast, irregular knocking sounds that came from up and down the line as arrows hurtled into wood or frozen canvas. The first to come to his wits was John Farr, who shouted orders from the centre of the line. Cold hands and stiff limbs moved to obey as yet more arrows flew down like rain, straight rods of rain, tipped with death. Lyra was in the open, and the arrows were passing over her head. Pantalaimon heard before she did, and became a leopard and knocked her over, making her less of a target. Brushing snow out of her eyes, she rolled over to try and see what was happening, for the semi-darkness seemed to be overflowing with confusion and noise. She heard a mighty roar and the clang and scrape of Yorick Birnison's armour as he leapt fully clad over the sledges and into the fog, and that was followed by screams, snarling, crunching and tearing sounds, great smashing blows, cries of terror and roars of bearish fury as he laid them waste. But who was them? Lyra had seen no enemy figures yet. The Egyptians were swarming to defend the sledges, but that, as even Lyra could see, made them better targets, and their rifles were not easy to fire in gloves and mittens. She'd only heard four or five shots as against the ceaseless, knocking rain of arrows, and more men fell every minute. "Oh, John Farr," she thought in anguish, "you didn't foresee this, and I didn't help you." But she had no more than a second to think that, for there was a mighty snarl from Pantalaimon, and something, another demon, hurtled at him and knocked him down, crushing all the breath out of Lyra herself. And then hands were hauling at her, lifting her, stifling her cry with foul-smelling mittens, tossing her through the air into another's arms, and then pushing her flat down into the snow again, so that she was dizzy and breathless and hurt all at once. Her arms were hauled behind till her shoulders cracked, and someone lashed her wrists together, and then a hood was crammed over her head to muffle her screams, for scream she did, and lustily.
"Yorick! Yorick Birnison! Help me!"
But could he hear? She couldn't tell. She was hurled this way and that, crushed onto a hard surface which then began to lurch and bump like a sledge. The sounds that reached her were wild and confused. She might have heard Yorick Birnison's roar, but it was a long way off, and then she was jolting over rough ground, arms twisted, mouth stifled, sobbing with rage and fear. And strange voices spoke around her.
"Pan?
I'm here.
Shh. I'll help you breathe. Keep still."
His mouse paws tugged at the hood until her mouth was freer, and she gulped at the frozen air.
"Who are they?"
"They look like Tartars. I think they hit John Farr."
"No."
"I saw him fall. But he should have been ready for this sort of attack. We know that."
"But we should have helped him. We should have been watching the alethiometer."
"Shh. Pretend to be unconscious."
There was a whip cracking and the howl of racing dogs. From the way she was being jerked and bounced about, Lyra could tell how fast they were going, and though she strained to hear the sounds of battle, all she made out was a forlorn volley of shots, muffled by the distance, and then the creak and rush and soft paw thuds in the snow were all there was to hear.
"They'll take us to the gobblers."
The word "severed" came to their mind. Horrible fear filled Lyra's body, and Pantalaimon nestled close against her.
"I'll fight."
"So will I. I'll kill them."
"So will Yorick when he finds out. He'll crush them to death."
"How far are we from Bolvanger?"
Pantalaimon didn't know, but he thought it was less than a day's ride. After they'd been driving along for such a time that Lyra's body was in torment from cramp, the pace slackened a little and someone roughly pulled off the hood. She looked up at a broad Asiatic face under a wolverine hood lit by flickering lamplight. His black eyes showed a glint of satisfaction, especially when Pantalaimon slid out of Lyra's anorak to bare his white ermine teeth in a hiss. The man's demon, A big, heavy wolverine snarled back, but Pantalaimon didn't flinch. The man hauled Lyra up to a sitting position and propped her against the side of the sledge. She kept falling sideways because her hands were still tied behind her, and so he tied her feet together instead and released her hands. Through the snow that was falling and the thick fog, she saw how powerful this man was, and the sledge driver too, how balanced in the sledge, how much at home in this land in a way the Egyptians weren't. The man spoke, but of course she understood nothing. He tried a different language with the same result. Then he tried English.
Your name?
Pantalaimon bristled warningly, and she knew what he meant at once. So these men didn't know who she was. They hadn't kidnapped her because of her connection with Mrs. Coulter. So perhaps they weren't in the pay of the gobblers after all.
Lizzie Brooks.
Lizzie Brooks. We take you nice place, nice peoples.
Who are you?
Samoyed peoples. Hunters.
Where are you taking me?
Nice place, nice peoples. You have Pansabiona?
For protection.
No good. Bear no good. We got you anyway.
He laughed loudly. Lyra controlled herself and said nothing.
Who those peoples?
The man asked next, pointing back the way they had come.
Traders.
Traders? What do they trade?
Fur, spirits, smoke leaf.
They sell smoke leaf? Buy furs?
Yes.
He said something to his companion, who spoke back briefly. All the time the sledge was speeding onwards, and Lyra pulled herself up more comfortably to try and see where they were heading. But the snow was falling thickly, and the sky was dark, and presently she became too cold to peer out any longer and lay down. She and Pantalaimon could feel each other's thoughts and tried to keep calm, but the thought of John Farr dead. And what had happened to Father Coram? And would Yorick manage to kill the other Samoyeds? And would they ever manage to track her down? For the first time, she began to feel a little sorry for herself. After a long time, the man shook her by the shoulder and handed her a strip of dried reindeer meat to chew. It was rank and tough, but she was hungry, and there was nourishment in it. After chewing it, she felt a little better. She slipped her hand slowly into her furs till she was sure the alethiometer was still there, and then carefully withdrew the spyfly tin and slipped it down into her fur boot. Pantalaimon crept in as a mouse and pushed it as far down as he could, tucking it under the bottom of her reindeer skin legging. When that was done, she closed her eyes. Fear had made her exhausted, and soon she slipped uneasily into sleep. She woke up when the motion of the sledge changed. It was suddenly smoother, and when she opened her eyes, there were passing lights dazzling above her, so bright she had to pull the hood further over her head before peering out again. She was horribly stiff and cold, but she managed to pull herself upright enough to see that the sledge was driving swiftly between a row of high poles, each carrying a glaring ambaric light. As she got her bearings, they passed through an open metal gate at the end of the avenue of lights and into a wide open space like an empty marketplace or an arena for some game or sport. It was perfectly flat and smooth and white, and about 100 yards across. Around the edge ran a high metal fence. At the far end of this arena, the sledge halted. They were outside a low building, or a range of low buildings, over which the snow lay deeply. It was hard to tell, but she had the impression that tunnels connected one part of the buildings with another, tunnels humped under the snow. At one side, a stout metal mast had a familiar look, though she couldn't say what it reminded her of. Before she could take much more in, the man in the sledge cut through the cord around her ankles and hauled her out roughly while the driver shouted at the dogs to make them still. A door opened in the building a few yards away, and an ambaric light came on overhead, swiveling to find them like a searchlight. Lyra's captor thrust her forward like a trophy, without letting go, and said something. The figure in the padded coal silk anorak answered in the same language, and Lyra saw his features. He was not a Samoyed or a Tartar. He could have been a Jordan scholar. He looked at her, and particularly at Pantalaimon. The Samoyed spoke again, and the man from Bolvanga said to Lyra,
"You speak English?"
"Yes."
"Does your demon always take that form?"
Of all the unexpected questions, Lyra could only gape. But Pantalaimon answered it in his own fashion by becoming a falcon and launching himself from her shoulder at the man's demon, a large marmot, which struck up at Pantalaimon with a swift movement and spat as he circled past on swift wings.
I see,
said the man in a tone of satisfaction, as Pantalaimon returned to Lyra's shoulder. The Samoyed men were looking expectant, and the man from Bolvanger nodded and took off a mitten to reach into a pocket. He took out a drawstring purse and counted out a dozen heavy coins into the hunter's hand. The two men checked the money and then stowed it carefully, each man taking half. Without a backward glance, they got in the sledge, and the driver cracked the whip and shouted to the dogs, and they sped away across the wide white arena and into the avenue of lights, gathering speed until they vanished into the dark beyond. The man was opening the door again.
Come in quickly. It's warm and comfortable. Don't stand out in the cold. What's your name?
His voice was an English one, without any accent Lyra could name. He sounded like the sort of people she had met at Mrs. Coulter's, smart and educated and important.
Lizzie Brooks.
Come in, Lizzie. We'll look after you here, don't worry.
He was colder than she was, even though she'd been outside for far longer. He was impatient to be in the warm again. She decided to play slow and dim-witted and reluctant, and dragged her feet as she stepped over the high threshold into the building. There were two doors, with a wide space between them so that not too much warm air escaped. Once they were through the inner doorway, Lyra found herself sweltering in what seemed unbearable heat and had to pull open her furs and push back her hood. They were in a space about 8 feet square, with corridors to the right and left, and in front of her the sort of reception desk you might see in a hospital. Everything was brilliantly lit, with a glint of shiny white surfaces and stainless steel. There was the smell of food in the air, familiar food, bacon and coffee, and under it a faint perpetual hospital medical smell. And coming from the walls all around was a slight humming sound, almost too low to hear, the sort of sound you had to get used to or go mad. Pantalaimon at her ear, a goldfinch now, whispered,
Be stupid and dim. Be really slow and stupid.
Adults were looking down at her. The man who'd brought her in, another man wearing a white coat, a woman in a nurse's uniform.
English,
the first man was saying.
Traders, apparently.
Usual hunters. Usual story.
Same tribe, as far as I could tell. Sister Clara, could you take little... and see to her?
Certainly, Doctor. Come with me, dear,
said the nurse, and Lyra obediently followed. They went along a short corridor with doors on the right and a canteen on the left, from which came a clatter of knives and forks and voices and more cooking smells. The nurse was about as old as Mrs. Coulter, Lyra guessed, with a brisk, blank, sensible air. She would be able to stitch a wound or change a bandage, but never to tell a story. Her demon, and Lyra had a moment of strange chill when she noticed, was a little white trotting dog, and after a moment she had no idea why it had chilled her.
What's your name, dear?
Said the nurse, opening a heavy door.
Lizzie.
Just Lizzie?
Lizzie Brooks.
And how old are you?
11.
Lyra had been told that she was small for her age, whatever that meant. It had never affected her sense of her own importance, but she realized that she could use the fact now to make Lizzie shy and nervous and insignificant, and shrank a little as she went into the room. She was half expecting questions about where she had come from and how she had arrived, and she was preparing answers. But it wasn't only imagination the nurse lacked, it was curiosity as well. Bolvanger might have been on the outskirts of London, and children might have been arriving all the time for all the interest Sister Clara seemed to show. Her pert, neat little demon trotted along at her heels just as brisk and blank as she was. In the room they entered, there was a couch and a table and two chairs and a filing cabinet, and a glass cupboard with medicines and bandages, and a wash basin. As soon as they were inside, nurse took Lyra's outer coat off and dropped it on the shiny floor.
Off with the rest, dear. We'll have a quick little look to see you're nice and healthy, no frostbite or sniffles, and then we'll find some nice clean clothes. We'll pop you in the shower too,
she added, for Lyra had not changed or washed for days, and in the enveloping warmth that was becoming more and more evident. Pantalaimon fluttered in protest, but Lyra quelled him with a scowl. He settled on the couch as one by one all Lyra's clothes came off, to her resentment and shame, but she still had the presence of mind to conceal it and act dull-witted and compliant.
And the money belt, Lizzie,
said the nurse, and untidied herself with strong fingers. She went to drop it on the pile with Lyra's other clothes, but stopped, feeling the edge of the alethiometer.
What's this?
She said, and unbuttoned the oilcloth.
Just a sort of toy. It's mine.
Yes, we won't take it away from you, dear,
said Sister Clara, unfolding the black velvet.
That's pretty, isn't it? Like a compass. Into the shower with you,
she went on, putting the alethiometer down and whisking back a cold silk curtain in the corner. Lyra reluctantly slipped under the warm water and soaped herself while Pantalaimon perched on the curtain rail. They were both conscious that he mustn't be too lively, for the demons of dull people were dull themselves. When she was washed and dry, the nurse took her temperature and looked into her eyes and ears and throat, and then measured her height and put her on some scales before writing a note on a clipboard. Then she gave Lyra some pyjamas and a dressing gown. They were clean and of good quality, like Tony Makarios's anorak, but again there was a second-hand air about them. Lyra felt very uneasy.
These ain't mine.
No, dear. Your clothes need a good wash.
Am I going to get my own ones back?
I expect so. Yes, of course.
What is this place?
It's called the Experimental Station.
That wasn't an answer, and whereas Lyra would have pointed that out and asked for more information, she didn't think Lizzie Brooks would. So she assented dumbly in the dressing and said no more.
I want my toy back,
she said stubbornly when she was dressed.
Take it, dear. Wouldn't you rather have a nice woolly bear, though, or a pretty doll?
She opened a drawer where some soft toys lay like dead things. Lyra made herself stand and pretend to consider for several seconds before picking out a rag doll with big vacant eyes. She had never had a doll, but she knew what to do and pressed it absently to her chest.
What about my money belt? I like to keep my toy in there.
Go on then, dear,
said Sister Clara, who was filling in a form on pink paper. Lyra hitched up her unfamiliar skirt and tied the oilskin pouch around her waist.
What about my coat and boots? And my mittens and things?
We'll have them cleaned for you,
said the nurse automatically. Then a telephone buzzed, and while the nurse answered it, Lyra stooped quickly to recover the other tin, the one containing the spy fly, and put it in the pouch with the alethiometer.
Come along, Lizzie,
said the nurse, putting the receiver down.
We'll go and find you something to eat. I expect you're hungry.
Lyra followed Sister Clara to the canteen, where a dozen round white tables were covered in crumbs and the sticky rings where drinks had been carelessly put down. Dirty plates and cutlery were stacked on a steel trolley. There were no windows, so to give an illusion of light and space, one wall was covered in a huge photogram showing a tropical beach, with bright blue sky and white sand and coconut palms. The man who had brought her in was collecting a tray from a serving hatch.
Eat up,
he said. There was no need to starve, so she ate the stew and mashed potatoes with relish. There was a bowl of tinned peaches and ice cream to follow. As she ate, the man and the nurse talked quietly at another table, and when she had finished, the nurse brought her a glass of warm milk and took the tray away. The man came to sit down opposite. His demon, the marmot, was not blank and incurious as the nurse's dog had been, but sat politely on his shoulder, watching and listening.
Now, Lizzie, have you eaten enough?
Yes, thank you.
I'd like you to tell me where you come from. Can you do that?
London.
And what are you doing so far north?
With my father,
she mumbled. She kept her eyes down, avoiding the gaze of the marmot, and trying to look as if she was on the verge of tears.
With your father, I see. And what's he doing in this part of the world?
Trading. We come with a load of new Danish smoke leaf, and we was buying furs.
And was your father by himself?
No. There was my uncles and all, and some other men,
she said vaguely, not knowing what the Samoyed hunter had told him.
Why did he bring you on a journey like this, Lizzie?
'Cause 2 years ago he brung my brother, and he says he'll bring me next, only he never. So I kept asking him, and then he did.
And how old are you?
11.
Good, good. Well, Lizzie, you're a lucky little girl. Those huntsmen who found you brought you to the best place you could be.
They never found me. There was a fight. There was lots of them, and they had arrows.
Oh, I don't think so. I think you must have wandered away from your father's party and got lost. Those huntsmen found you on your own and brought you straight here. That's what happened, Lizzie.
I saw a fight. They were shooting arrows and that. I want my dad,
she said more loudly, and felt herself beginning to cry.
Well, you're quite safe here until he comes,
said the doctor.
But I saw them shooting arrows.
Ah, you thought you did. That often happens in the intense cold, Lizzie. You fall asleep and have bad dreams, and you can't remember what's true and what isn't. That wasn't a fight. Don't worry. Your father is safe and sound, and he'll be looking for you now, and soon he'll come here, because this is the only place for hundreds of miles, you know. And what a surprise he'll have to find you safe and sound. Now, Sister Clara will take you along to the dormitory, where you'll meet some other little girls and boys who got lost in the wilderness just like you. Off you go. We'll have another little talk in the morning.
Lyra stood up, clutching her doll, and Pantalaimon hopped onto her shoulder as the nurse opened the door to lead them out. More corridors, and Lyra was tired by now, so sleepy she kept yawning and could hardly lift her feet in the woolly slippers they'd given her. Pantalaimon was drooping, and he had to change to a mouse and settle inside her dressing gown pocket. Lyra had the impression of a row of beds, children's faces, a pillow, and then she was asleep. Someone was shaking Lyra. The first thing she did was to feel at her waist, and both tins were there, still safe. So she tried to open her eyes, but oh, it was hard. She had never felt so sleepy.
Wake up!
It was a whisper in more than one voice. With a huge effort, as if she were pushing a boulder up a slope, Lyra forced herself to wake up. In the dim light from a very low-powered anbaric bulb over the doorway, she saw three other girls clustered around her. It wasn't easy to see because her eyes were slow to focus, but they seemed about her own age, and they were speaking English.
She's awake! They gave her sleeping pills. Must have.
What's your name?
Lizzie.
Is there a load more new kids coming?
Demanded one of the girls.
Dunno, just me.
Where'd they get you then?
Lyra struggled to sit up. She didn't remember taking a sleeping pill, but there might well have been something in the drink she'd had. Her head felt full of eiderdown, and there was a faint pain throbbing behind her eyes.
Where is this place?
Middle of nowhere. They don't tell us.
They usually bring more than one kid at a time.
What do they do?
Lyra managed to ask, gathering her doped wits as Pantalaimon stirred into wakefulness with her.
We don't know,
said the girl who was doing most of the talking. She was a tall, red-haired girl with quick, twitchy movements and a strong London accent.
They sort of measure us and do these tests and that.
They measure dust,
said another girl, friendly and plump and dark-haired.
You don't know,
said the first girl.
They do,
said the third, a subdued-looking child cuddling her rabbit demon.
I heard them talking.
Then they take us away, one by one, and that's all we know. No one comes back.
There's this boy, right? He reckons...
Don't tell her that. Not yet.
Is there boys here as well?
Yeah, there's lots of us. There's about 30, I reckon.
More than that, more like 40.
Except they keep taking us away. They usually start off with bringing a whole bunch here, and then there's a lot of us, and one by one they all disappear.
They're gobblers. You know, gobblers. We was all scared of them till we was caught.
Lyra was gradually coming more and more awake. The other girl's demons, apart from the rabbit, were close by listening at the door, and no one spoke above a whisper. Lyra asked their names. The red-haired girl was Annie, the dark plump one Bella, the thin one Martha. They didn't know the names of the boys because the two sexes were kept apart for most of the time. They weren't treated badly.
It's all right here,
said Bella.
There's not much to do, except they give us tests and make us do exercises, and then they measure us and take our temperature and stuff. It's just boring, really.
Except when Mrs. Coulter comes,
said Annie. Lyra had to stop herself crying out, and Pantalaimon fluttered his wings so sharply that the other girls noticed.
He's nervous,
said Lyra, soothing him.
They must have gave us some sleeping pills, like you said, because we're all dozy. Who's Mrs. Coulter?
She's the one who trapped us. Most of us, anyway,
said Martha.
They all talk about her, the other kids. When she comes, you know there's going to be kids disappearing. She likes watching the kids. When they take us away, she likes seeing what they do to us. This boy Simon, he reckons they kill us and Mrs. Coulter watches.
They kill us?
Said Lyra, shuddering.
Must do, because no one comes back. They're always going on about demons, too, weighing them and measuring them and all.
They touch your demons.
No, God. They put scales there and your demon has to get on them and change. And they make notes and take pictures. And they put you in this cabinet and measure dust. All the time, they never stop measuring dust.
What dust?
We don't know. Just something from space. Not real dust. If you ain't got any dust, that's good. But everyone gets dust in the end.
You know what I heard Simon say?
What?
He said that the Tartars make holes in their skulls to let the dust in.
Yeah, he'd know.
I think I'll ask Mrs. Coulter when she comes.
You wouldn't dare.
I would.
When's she coming?
The day after tomorrow.
A cold drench of terror went down Lyra's spine, and Pantalaimon crept very close. She had one day in which to find Roger and discover whatever she could about this place, and either escape or be rescued. And if all the Egyptians had been killed, who would help the children stay alive in the icy wilderness? The other girls went on talking, but Lyra and Pantalaimon nestled down deep in the bed and tried to get warm, knowing that for hundreds of miles all around her little bed, there was nothing but fear. Chapter 15. that demon cages. It wasn't Lyra's way to brood. She was a sanguine and practical child, and besides, she wasn't imaginative. No one with much imagination would have thought seriously that it was possible to come all this way and rescue her friend Roger. Or, having thought it, an imaginative child would immediately have come up with several ways in which it was impossible. Being a practiced liar doesn't mean you have a powerful imagination. Many good liars have no imagination at all. It's that which gives their lies such wide-eyed conviction. So now that she was in the hands of the Oblation Board, Lyra didn't fret herself into terror about what had happened to the Chipchins. They were all good fighters, and even though Pantalaimon said he'd seen John Farr shot, he might have been mistaken. Or if he wasn't mistaken, John Farr might not have been seriously hurt. It had been bad luck that she'd fallen into the hands of the Samoyeds, but the Egyptians would be along soon to rescue her, and if they couldn't manage it, nothing would stop Yorick Birnison from getting her out. And then they'd fly to Svalbard in Lee Scoresby's balloon and rescue Lord Asriel. In her mind, it was as easy as that. So next morning, when she awoke in the dormitory, she was curious and ready to deal with whatever the day would bring, and eager to see Roger. In particular, eager to see him before he saw her. She didn't have long to wait. The children in their different dormitories were woken at 7:30 by the nurses who looked after them. They washed and dressed and went with the others to the canteen for breakfast. And there was Roger. He was sitting with 5 other boys at a table just inside the door. The line for the hatch went right past them, and she was able to pretend to drop a handkerchief and crouch to pick it up, bending low next to his chair, so that Pantalaimon could speak to Roger's demon, Salsilia. She was a chaffinch, and she fluttered so wildly that Pantalaimon had to be a cat and leap at her, pinning her down to whisper. Such brisk fights or scuffles between children's demons were common, luckily, and no one took much notice, but Roger went pale at once. Lyra had never seen anyone so white. He looked up at the blank, haughty stare she gave him, and the colour flooded back into his cheeks as he brimmed over with hope, excitement, and joy. And only Pantalaimon, shaking Salsilia firmly, was able to keep Roger from shouting out and leaping up to greet his best friend, his comrade in arms, his Lyra. But he saw how she looked away disdainfully, and he followed her example faithfully, as he'd done in 100 Oxford battles and campaigns. No one must know, of course, because they were both in deadly danger. She rolled her eyes at her new friends, and they collected their trays of cornflakes and toast and sat together, an instant gang, excluding everyone else in order to gossip about them. You can't keep a large group of children in one place for long without giving them plenty to do. And in some ways Bolvanger was run like a school with timetabled activities such as gymnastics and art. Boys and girls were kept separate except for breaks and mealtimes, so it wasn't until mid-morning, after 1.5 hours of sewing directed by one of the nurses, that Lyra had the chance to talk to Roger. But it had to look natural, that was the difficulty. All the children there were more or less at the same age, and it was the age when most boys talk to boys and girls to girls, each making a conspicuous point of ignoring the opposite sex. She found her chance in the canteen again, when the children came in for a drink and a biscuit. Lyra sent Pantalaimon as a fly to talk to Salsilia on the wall next to their table while she and Roger kept quietly in their separate groups. It was difficult to talk while your demon's attention was somewhere else, so Lyra pretended to look glum and rebellious as she sipped her milk with the other girls. Half her thoughts were with a tiny buzz of talk between the demons, and she wasn't really listening. But at one point she heard another girl with bright blonde hair say a name that made her sit up. It was the name of Tony Makarios. As Lyra's attention snapped towards that, Pantalaimon had to slow down his whispered conversation with Roger's demon, and both children listened to what the girl was saying.
"No, I know why they took him,"
she said, as heads clustered close nearby.
"It was because his demon didn't change. They thought he was older than he looked or something, and he weren't really a young kid. But really his demon never changed very often because Tony herself never thought much about anything. I seen a change. She was called Ratter."
"Why are they so interested in demons?"
"No one knows,"
said the blonde girl.
"I know,"
said one boy who'd been listening.
"What they do is kill your demon and then see if you die."
"Well, how can they do it over and over with different kids?"
said someone.
"They'd only need to do it once, wouldn't they?"
"I know what they do,"
said the first girl. She had everyone's attention now, but because they didn't want to let the staff know what they were talking about, they had to adopt a strange, half-careless, indifferent manner while listening with passionate curiosity.
"How?"
said someone.
"'Cause I was with him when they came for him. We was in the linen room."
She was blushing hotly. If she was expecting jeers and teasing, they didn't come. All the children were subdued, and no one even smiled. The girl went on.
We was keeping quiet, and then the nurse came in, the one with the soft voice, and she says, "Come on, Tony, I know you're in there. Come on, we won't hurt you." And he says, "What's going to happen?" And she says, "We just put you to sleep and then we do a little operation and then you wake up safe and sound." But Tony didn't believe her. He says,
"The holes! They make a hole in your head like the Tartars, I bet!"
"Shut up! What else did the nurse say?"
By this time, a dozen or more children were clustered around her table, their demons as desperate to know as they were, all wide-eyed and tense. The blonde girl went on.
Tony wanted to know what they was going to do with Rattersea. And the nurse says, "Well, she's going to go to sleep too, just like when you do." And Tony says, "You're going to kill her, ain't you? I know you are. We all know that's what happens." And the nurse says, "No, of course not. It's just a little operation, just a little cut. It won't even hurt, but we put you to sleep to make sure."
All the room had gone quiet now. The nurse who'd been supervising had left for a moment, and the hatch to the kitchen was shut, so no one could hear from there.
"What sort of cut? Did she say what sort of cut?"
"She just said it's something to make you more grown up. She said everyone had to have it. That's why grown-ups' demons don't change like ours do. So they have a cut to make them one shape forever. And that's how you get grown up."
"But does that mean..."
"What, all grown-ups have had this cut?
What about..."
Suddenly all the voices stopped as if they themselves had been cut, and all eyes turned to the door. Sister Clara stood there, bland and mild and matter-of-fact, and beside her was a man in a white coat whom Lyra hadn't seen before.
"Bridget McGinn,"
he said. The blonde girl stood up, trembling. Her squirrel demon clutched her breast.
"Yes, sir."
"Finish your drink and come with Sister Clara. The rest of you run along and go to your classes."
Obediently, the children stacked their mugs on the stainless steel trolley before leaving in silence. No one looked at Bridget McGinn except Lyra, and she saw the blonde girl's face vivid with fear. The rest of that morning was spent in exercise. There was a small gymnasium at the station because it was hard to exercise outside during the long polar night, and each group of children took turns to play in there under the supervision of a nurse. They had to form teams and throw balls around, and at first Lyra, who had never in her life played at anything like this, was at a loss what to do. But she was quick and athletic and a natural leader, and soon found herself enjoying it. The shouts of the children, the shrieks and hoots of the demons, filled the little gymnasium and soon banished fearful thoughts, which, of course, was exactly what the exercise was intended to do. At lunchtime, when the children were lining up once again in the canteen, Lyra felt Pantalaimon give a chirrup of recognition and turned to find Billy Costa standing just behind her.
"Roger told me you was here."
"Your brother's coming, and John Farr, and a whole band of Egyptians. They're going to take you home."
He nearly cried aloud with joy, but subdued the cry into a cough.
"And you got to call me Lizzie, never Lyra. And you got to tell me everything you know, right?"
They sat together with Roger close by. It was easier to do this at lunchtime, when children spent more time coming and going between the tables and the counter, where bland-looking adults served equally bland food. Under the clatter of knives and forks and plates, Billy and Roger both told her as much as they knew. Billy had heard from a nurse that children who had had the operation were often taken to hostels further south, which might explain how Tony Makarios came to be wandering in the wild. But Roger had something even more interesting to tell her.
"I found a hiding place."
"What? Where?"
"See that picture?"
He meant the big photogram of the tropical beach.
"If you look in the top right corner, you see that ceiling panel?"
The ceiling consisted of large rectangular panels set in a framework of metal strips, and the corner of the panel above the picture had lifted slightly.
"I saw that, and I thought the others might be like it. So I lifted them, and they're all loose. They just lift up. Well, me and this boy tried it one night in our dormitory before they took him away. There's a space up there, and you can crawl inside."
"How far can you crawl in the ceiling?"
"I don't know. We just went in a little way. We reckoned when it was time we could hide up there, but they'd probably find us."
Lyra saw it not as a hiding place, but as a highway. It was the best thing she'd heard since she'd arrived. But before they could talk any more, a doctor banged on a table with a spoon and began to speak.
"Listen, children. Listen carefully. Every so often we have to have a fire drill. It's very important that we all get dressed properly and make our way outside without any panic. So we're going to have a practice fire drill this afternoon. When the bell rings, you must stop whatever you're doing and do what the nearest grown-up says. Remember where they take you. That's the place you must go to if there's a real fire."
Well, thought Lyra, there's an idea. During the first part of the afternoon, Lyra and four other girls were tested for dust. The doctors didn't say that was what they were doing, but it was easy to guess. They were taken one by one to a laboratory, and of course this made them all very frightened. How cruel it would be, Lyra thought, if she perished without striking a blow at them. But they were not going to do that operation just yet, it seemed.
We want to make some measurements,
the doctor explained. It was hard to tell the difference between these people. All the men looked similar in their white coats and with their clipboards and pencils, and the women resembled one another too, the uniforms and their strange, bland, calm manner making them all look like sisters.
I was measured yesterday.
Ah, we're making different measurements today. Stand on the metal plate. Slip your shoes off first. Hold your demon if you like. Look forward, that's it. Stare at the little green light, good girl.
Something flashed. The doctor made her face the other way and then to left and right, and each time something clicked and flashed.
That's fine. Now, come over to this machine and put your hand into the tube. Nothing to harm you, I promise. Straighten your fingers. That's it.
What are you measuring? Is it dust?
Who told you about dust?
One of the other girls. I don't know her name. She said we was all over dust. I ain't dusty. At least I don't think I am. I had a shower yesterday.
Ah, it's a different sort of dust. You can't see it with your ordinary eyesight. It's a special dust. Now, clench your fist. That's right. Good. Now, if you feel around in there, you'll find a sort of handle thing. Got that? Take hold of that. There's a good girl. Now, can you put your other hand over this way? Rest it on this brass globe. Good. Fine. Now you'll feel a slight tingling. Nothing to worry about. It's just a slight anbaric current.
Pantalaimon, in his most tense and wary wildcat form, prowled with lightning-eyed suspicion around the apparatus, continually returning to rub himself against Lyra. She was sure by now that they weren't going to perform the operation on her yet, and sure, too, that her disguise as Lizzie Brooks was secure. So she risked a question.
Why do you cut people's demons away?
What? Who's been talking to you about that?
This girl, I don't know her name. She said you cut people's demons away.
Nonsense.
He was agitated, though. She went on.
Because you take people out one by one, and they never come back. And some people reckon you just kill them. And other people say different. And this girl told me you cut...
It's not true at all. When we take children out, it's because it's time for them to move on to another place. They're growing up. I'm afraid your friend is alarming herself. Nothing of the sort. Don't even think about it. Who is your friend?
I only come here yesterday. I don't know anyone's name.
What does she look like?
I forget. I think she had sort of brown hair. Light brown, maybe. I don't know.
The doctor went to speak quietly to the nurse. As the two of them conferred, Lyra watched their demons. This nurse's was a pretty bird, just as neat and incurious as Sister Clara's dog, and the doctor's was a large, heavy moth. Neither moved. They were awake, for the bird's eyes were bright and the moth's feelers waved languidly, but they weren't animated as she would have expected them to be. Perhaps they weren't really anxious or curious at all. Presently the doctor came back and they went on with the examination, weighing her and Pantalaimon separately, looking at her from behind a special screen, measuring her heartbeat, placing her under a little nozzle that hissed and gave off a smell like fresh air. In the middle of one of the tests, a loud bell began to ring and kept ringing.
Oh, the fire alarm. Very well. Lizzie, follow Sister Betty.
But all their outdoor clothes are down in the dormitory building, Doctor. She can't go outside like this. Should we go there first, do you think?
He was annoyed at having his experiments interrupted and snapped his fingers in irritation.
I suppose this is just the sort of thing the practice is meant to show up. Oh, what a nuisance.
When I came yesterday, Sister Clara put my other clothes in a cupboard in that first room where she looked at me. The one next door. I could wear them.
Good idea. Quick, then.
With a secret glee, Lyra hurried there behind the nurse and retrieved her proper furs and leggings and boots and pulled them on quickly while the nurse dressed herself in coal silk. Then they hurried out. In the wide arena in front of the main group of buildings, 100 or so people, adults and children, were milling about. Some in excitement, some in irritation, many just bewildered.
See?
One adult was saying.
It's worth doing this to find out what chaos we'd be in with a real fire.
Someone was blowing a whistle and waving his arms, but no one was taking much notice. Lyra saw Roger and beckoned. Roger tugged Billy Costa's arm, and soon all three of them were together in a maelstrom of running children.
No one will notice if we take a look around. It'll take them ages to count everyone, and we can just say we followed someone else and got lost.
They waited till most of the grown-ups were looking the other way, and then Lyra scooped up some snow and rammed it into a loose powdery snowball and hurled it at random into the crowd. In a moment, all the children were doing it, and the air was full of flying snow. Screams of laughter covered completely the shouts of the adults trying to regain control, and then the three children were around the corner and out of sight. The snow was so thick that they couldn't move quickly, but it didn't seem to matter. No one was following. Lyra and the others scrambled over the curved roof of one of the tunnels and found themselves in a strange moonscape of regular hummocks and hollows, all swathed in white under the black sky and lit by reflections from the lights around the arena.
"What are we looking for?"
said Billy.
"Dunno. Just looking,"
said Lyra, and led the way to a squat square building a little apart from the rest, with a low-powered anbaric light at the corner. The hubbub from behind was as loud as ever, but more distant. Clearly the children were making the most of their freedom, and Lyra hoped they'd keep it up for as long as they could. She moved around the edge of the square building, looking for a window. The roof was only 7 feet or so off the ground, and unlike the other buildings, it had no roofed tunnel to connect it with the rest of the station. There was no window, but there was a door. A notice above it said, "Entry strictly forbidden," in red letters. Lyra set her hand on it to try, but before she could turn the handle, Roger said,
"Look! A bird! Or..."
His "or" was an exclamation of doubt, because the creature swooping down from the black sky was no bird at all. It was someone Lyra had seen before.
"The witch's demon!"
The goose beat his great wings, raising a flurry of snow as he landed.
"Greetings, Lyra. I followed you here, though you didn't see me. I have been waiting for you to come out into the open. What is happening?"
She told him quickly.
"Where are the Egyptians? Is Jonfar safe? Did they fight off the Samoyeds?"
"Most of them are safe. Jonfar is wounded, though not severely. The men who took you were hunters and raiders who often prey on parties of travellers, and alone they can travel more quickly than a large party. The Egyptians are still a day's journey away."
The two boys were staring in fear at the goose demon and at Lyra's familiar manner with him, because, of course, they'd never seen a demon without his human before, and they knew little about witches. Lyra said to them,
"Listen, you better go and keep watch, right? Billy, you go that way, and Roger, watch out the way we just come. We ain't got long."
They ran off to do as she said, and then Lyra turned back to the door.
"Why are you trying to get in there?"
"Because of what they do here. They cut people's demons away, children's, and I think maybe they do it in here. At least there's something here, and I was going to look, but it's locked."
"I can open it,"
said the goose, and beat his wings once or twice, throwing snow up against the door. And as he did, Lyra heard something turn in the lock.
"Go in carefully,"
said the demon. Lyra pulled open the door against the snow and slipped inside. The goose demon came with her. Pantalaimon was agitated and fearful, but he didn't want the witch's demon to see his fear, so he had flown to Lyra's breast and taken sanctuary inside her furs. As soon as her eyes had adjusted to the light, Lyra saw why. In a series of glass cases on shelves around the walls were all the demons of the severed children. Ghost-like forms of cats, or birds, or rats, or other creatures, each bewildered and frightened and as pale as smoke. The witch's demon gave a cry of anger, and Lyra clutched Pantalaimon to her and said,
"Don't look! Don't look!"
"Where are the children of these demons?"
said the goose demon, shaking with rage. Lyra explained fearfully about her encounter with little Tony Makarios, and looked over her shoulder at the poor caged demons who were clustering forward, pressing their pale faces to the glass. Lyra could hear faint cries of pain and misery. In the dim light from a low-powered anbaric bulb, she could see a name on a card at the front of each case, and yes, there was an empty one with Tony Makarios on it. There were 4 or 5 other empty ones with names on them, too.
"I want to let these poor things go. I'm going to smash the glass and let them out."
And she looked around for something to do it with, but the place was bare. The goose demon said,
"Wait."
He was a witch's demon, and much older than she was, and stronger. She had to do as he said.
"We must make these people think someone forgot to lock the place and shut the cages. If they see broken glass and footprints in the snow, how long do you think your disguise will last? And it must hold out till the Egyptians come. Now do exactly as I say. Take a handful of snow, and when I tell you, blow a little of it against each cage in turn."
She ran outside. Roger and Billy were still on guard, and there was still a noise of shrieking and laughter from the arena, because only a minute or so had gone by. She grabbed a big double handful of the light powdery snow and then came back to do as the goose demon said. As she blew a little snow on each cage, the goose made a clicking sound in his throat and the catch at the front of the cage came open. When she had unlocked them all, she lifted the front of the first one and the pale form of a sparrow fluttered out but fell to the ground before she could fly. The goose tenderly bent and nudged her upright with his beak and the sparrow became a mouse, staggering and confused. Pantalaimon leapt down to comfort her. Lyra worked quickly, and within a few minutes every demon was free. Some were trying to speak, and they clustered around her feet and even tried to pluck at her leggings, though the taboo held them back. She could tell why, poor things. They missed the heavy, solid warmth of their humans' bodies. Just as Pantalaimon would have done, they longed to press themselves against a heartbeat.
Now, quick, Lara, you must run back and mingle with the other children. Be brave, child. The Egyptians are coming as fast as they can. I must help these poor demons to find their people.
He came closer and said quietly.
But they'll never be one again. They are sundered forever. This is the most wicked thing I have ever seen. Leave the footprints you've made. I'll cover them up. Hurry now.
Oh, please, before you go, witches, they do fly, don't they? I wasn't dreaming when I saw them flying the other night.
Yes, child, why?
Could they pull a balloon?
Undoubtedly, but...
Will Serafina Pekala be coming?
There isn't time to explain the politics of witch nations. There are vast powers involved here, and Serafina Pekala must guard the interests of her clan, but it may be that what's happening here is part of all that's happening elsewhere. Lyra, you'll need it inside. Run, run!
She ran, and Roger, who was watching wide-eyed as the pale demons drifted out of the building, waded towards her through the thick snow.
They're... It's like the crypt in Jordan. They're demons.
Yes, hush. Don't tell Billy, though. Don't tell anyone yet. Come on back.
Behind them, the goose was beating his wings powerfully, throwing snow over the tracks they'd made. And near him, the lost demons were clustering or drifting away, crying little bleak cries of loss and longing. When the footprints were covered, the goose turned to herd the pale demons together. He spoke, and one by one they changed, though you could see the effort it cost them, until they were all birds. And like fledglings, they followed the witch's demon, fluttering and falling and running through the snow after him, and finally, with great difficulty, taking off. They rose in a ragged line, pale and spectral against the deep black sky, and slowly gained height, feeble and erratic though some of them were, and though others lost their will and fluttered downwards. But the great grey goose wheeled round and nudged them back, herding them gently on until they were lost against the profound dark. Roger was tugging at Lyra's arm.
Quick, they're nearly ready!
They stumbled away to join Billy, who was beckoning from the corner of the main building. The children were tired now, or else the adults had regained some authority, because people were lining up raggedly by the main door with much jostling and pushing. Lyra and the other two slipped out from the corner and mingled with them, but before they did, Lyra said,
Pass the word around among all the kids. They've got to be ready to escape. They've got to know where the outdoor clothes are and be ready to get them and run out as soon as we give the signal. And they've got to keep this a deadly secret, understand?
Billy nodded, and Roger said,
What's the signal?
The fire bell. When the time comes, I'll set it off.
They waited to be counted off. If anyone in the Oblation Board had had anything to do with the school, they would have arranged this better. Because they had no regular group to go to, each child had to be ticked off against the complete list, and of course they weren't in alphabetical order, and none of the adults was used to keeping control. So there was a good deal of confusion, despite the fact that no one was running around anymore. Lyra watched and noticed. They weren't very good at this at all. They were slack in a lot of ways, these people. They grumbled about fire drills, they didn't know where the outdoor clothes should be kept, they couldn't get children to stand in line properly. And their slackness might be to her advantage. They had almost finished when there came another distraction, though, and from Lyra's point of view, it was the worst possible. She heard the sound as everyone else did. Heads began to turn and scan the dark sky for the Zeppelin, whose gas engine was throbbing clearly in the still air. The one lucky thing was that it was coming from the direction opposite to the one in which the grey goose had flown. But that was the only comfort. Very soon it was visible, and a murmur of excitement went around the crowd. Its fat, sleek, silver form drifted over the avenue of lights, and its own lights blazed downward from the nose and the cabin slung beneath the body. The pilot cut the speed and began the complex business of adjusting the height. Lyra realized what the stout mast was for. Of course, it was a mooring mast. As the adults ushered the children inside, with everyone staring back and pointing, the ground crew clambered up the ladders in the mast and prepared to attach the mooring cables. The engines were roaring, and snow was swirling up from the ground, and the faces of passengers showed in the cabin windows. Lyra looked, and there was no mistake. Pantalaimon clutched at her, became a wildcat, hissed in hatred, because looking out with curiosity was the beautiful dark-haired head of Mrs. Coulter, with her golden demon in her lap. Chapter 16. The Silver Guillotine. Lyra ducked her head at once under the shelter of her wolverine hood, and shuffled in through the double doors with the other children. Time enough later to worry about what she'd say when they came face to face. She had another problem to deal with first, and that was how to hide her furs where she could get at them without asking permission. But luckily there was such disorder inside, with the adults trying to hurry the children through so as to clear the way for the passengers from the Zeppelin, that no one was watching very carefully. Lyra slipped out of the anorak, the leggings and the boots, and bundled them up as small as she could before shoving through the crowded corridors to her dormitory. Quickly she dragged a locker to the corner, stood on it, and pushed at the ceiling. The panel lifted, just as Roger had said, and into the space beyond she thrust the boots and leggings. As an afterthought, she took the alethiometer from her pouch and hid it in the inmost pocket of the anorak before shoving that through, too. She jumped down, pushed back the locker, and whispered to Pantalaimon,
"We must just pretend to be stupid till she sees us, and then say we were kidnapped, and nothing about the Egyptians or Yorick Bernison especially."
Because Lyra now realized, if she hadn't done so before, that all the fear in her nature was drawn to Mrs. Coulter as a compass needle is drawn to the pole. All the other things she'd seen, and even the hideous cruelty of the intercision, she could cope with. She was strong enough. But the thought of that sweet face and gentle voice, the image of that golden, playful monkey, was enough to melt her stomach and make her pale and nauseated. But the Egyptians were coming. Think of that. Think of Yorick Bernison. "And don't give yourself away," she said, and drifted back towards the canteen from where a lot of noise was coming. Children were lining up to get hot drinks, some of them still in their cold silk anoraks. Their talk was all of the Zeppelin and its passenger.
"It was her, with the monkey demon.
Did she get you too?"
"She said she'd write to my mum and dad, and I bet she never."
"She never told us about kids getting killed. She never said nothing about that."
"That monkey, he's the worst. He caught my carosser and nearly killed her. I could feel all weak."
They were as frightened as Lyra was. She found Annie and the others, sat down.
"Listen, can you keep a secret?"
"Yeah."
The three faces turned to her, vivid with expectation.
"There's a plan to escape. There's some people coming to take us away, right? And they'll be here in about a day, maybe sooner. What we all got to do is be ready as soon as the signal goes and get our cold weather clothes at once and run out. No waiting about, you just got to run. Only if you don't get your anoraks and boots and stuff, you'll die of cold."
"What signal?"
Annie demanded.
"The fire bell. Light this afternoon. It's all organised. All the kids are going to know, and none of the grown-ups. Especially not her."
Their eyes were gleaming with hope and excitement, and all through the canteen the message was being passed around. Lyra could tell that the atmosphere had changed. Outside, the children had been energetic and eager for play. Then, when they'd seen Mrs. Coulter, they were bubbling with a suppressed hysterical fear. But now there was a control and purpose to their talkativeness. Lyra marvelled at the effect hope could have. She watched through the open doorway, but carefully, ready to duck her head, because there were adult voices coming. And then Mrs. Coulter herself was briefly visible, looking in and smiling at the happy children, with their hot drinks and their cake, so warm and well-fed. A little shiver ran almost instantaneously through the whole canteen, and every child was still and silent, staring at her. Mrs. Coulter smiled and passed on without a word. Little by little, the talk started again.
"Where do they go to talk?"
"Probably the conference room,"
said Annie.
"They took us there once,"
she added, meaning her and her demon.
"There was about 20 grown-ups there, and one of them was giving a lecture, and I had to stand there and do what he told me, like seeing how far my carillion could go away from me. And then he hypnotised me and did some other things. It's a big room with a lot of chairs and tables and a little platform. It's behind the front office.
Hey, I bet they're going to pretend the fire drill went off all right. I bet they're scared of us same as we are."
For the rest of the day, Lyra stayed close to the other girls, watching, saying little, remaining inconspicuous. There was exercise, there was sewing, there was supper, there was playtime in the lounge, a big shabby room with board games and a few tattered books and a table tennis table. At some point, Lyra and the others became aware that there was some kind of subdued emergency going on, because the adults were hurrying to and fro or standing in anxious groups talking urgently. Lyra guessed they discovered the demon's escape and were wondering how it had happened. But she didn't see Mrs. Coulter, which was a relief. When it was time for bed, she knew she had to let the other girls into her confidence.
"Listen, do they ever come round and see if we're asleep?"
"They just look in once,"
said Bella.
"They just flash a lantern round. They don't really look."
"Good, because I'm going to go and look round. There's a way through the ceiling that this boy showed me,"
she explained, and before she'd even finished, Annie said,
"I'll come with you."
"No, you better not, because it'll be easier if there's just one person missing. You can all say you fell asleep, and you don't know where I've gone."
"But if I came with you..."
"More likely to get caught."
Their two demons were staring at each other, Pantalaimon as a wildcat, Annie's carillion as a fox. They were quivering. Pantalaimon uttered the lowest, softest hiss and bared his teeth, and carillion turned aside and began to groom himself unconcernedly.
"All right, then."
It was quite common for struggles between children to be settled by their demons in this way, with one accepting the dominance of the other. Their humans accepted the outcome without resentment on the whole, so Lyra knew that Annie would do as she asked. They all contributed items of clothing to bulk out Lyra's bed and make it look as if she was still there, and swore to say they knew nothing about it. Then Lyra listened at the door to make sure no one was coming, jumped up on the locker, pushed up the panel, and hauled herself through.
"Just don't say anything,"
she whispered down to the three faces watching. Then she dropped the panel gently back into place and looked around. She was crouching in a narrow metal channel supported in a framework of girders and struts. The panels of the ceiling were slightly translucent, so some light came up from below, and in the faint gleam Lyra could see this narrow space, only 2 feet or so in height, extending in all directions around her. It was crowded with metal ducts and pipes, and it would be easy to get lost in, but provided she kept to the metal and avoided putting any weight on the panels, and as long as she made no noise, she should be able to go from one end of the station to the other.
"It's just like back in Jordan, Pan, looking in the retiring room."
"If you hadn't done that, none of this would have happened."
"Then it's up to me to undo it, isn't it?"
She got her bearings, working out approximately which direction the conference room was in, and then set off. It was a far from easy journey. She had to move on hands and knees because the space was too low to crouch in, and every so often she had to squeeze under a big square duct or lift herself over some heating pipes. The metal channels she crawled in followed the tops of internal walls as far as she could tell, and as long as she stayed in them she felt a comforting solidity below her. But they were very narrow and had sharp edges, so sharp that she cut her knuckles and her knees on them, and before long she was sore all over and cramped and dusty. But she knew roughly where she was, and she could see the dark bulk of her furs crammed in above the dormitory to guide her back. She could tell where her room was empty because the panels were dark, and from time to time she heard voices from below and stopped to listen, but it was only the cooks in the kitchen or the nurses in what Lyra, in her Jordan way, thought of as their common room. They were saying nothing interesting, so she moved on.